So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming tonight. Before we return to our pith teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, so you've been in, is there anybody who is new tonight? Oh, okay. So usually there is a formal talk, but before the talk begins, there's an opportunity for anybody, new or old, to ask any questions about this, specifically about the meditation practices we've done here tonight, but even more importantly, or as importantly, since everyone here, I'm sure, is trying to take the teachings and practices of healing and transformation into their daily life, and meeting with some degree of success or not, this is an opportunity to, if you have any questions about the practice, about meditation in daily life, and just about how to bring the teachings and practices into one's life to really remediate difficulty, conflict, suffering, dissatisfaction, which is what it's all about. As I said on retreat, we had a wonderful 7-day retreat up in the mountains of North Carolina a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that I said to people up there, can you hear me? Okay. Was that the object of spiritual practice, in this case, the practice that I'm most familiar with, which is the practices of Buddha's way, is not about moving from maximum security to minimum security prison. And that's important for us to understand, because many of us find that the practices of meditation, the practices of spirituality, help us do that. Maximum security prison is heavy duty. It's not a fun place, is it? You can say maximum security is hell. There's a lot of suffering. A minimum security prison is, compared to maximum security prison, is a picnic. Things are better. There's much less suffering in minimum security prison as opposed to maximum security. Of course, the truth is what? You're still not free, even in minimum security. And the object of spiritual practice is to be free, to be liberated from our conditioning, from our drama, from our self-centeredness, from always being caught in the story of self and other, and to really be free. So that is not easy. And often, because meditation can be used as a very effective coping mechanism, it does have the capacity of making our life easier, making our minds a little more at ease. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's wonderful. But it's also important to know that even though we are perhaps a little more comfortable in our lives, there's still much more that we can do to really experience the innate freedom and naturalness and openness of our heart and mind, and to really learn how to live an awakened life, which is really, really the true, certain people think, the true meaning of life, the true purpose of life. Again, which is a strange thing to say, right? Because in our society, we're often told the true meaning and purpose of life is what? Stuff, to get as much stuff as we can. More stuff, better stuff, bigger stuff, more luxurious stuff, right? Or at least to accumulate wealth, to accumulate power, to accumulate status, to accumulate fame. Right? Those are the kind of things. Or at least rise up. Wherever you are, rise up the next step, right? Why not go even more steps? So that is, I mean, that is the emphasis of our society. And again, that's not all bad. But in terms of real meaning and happiness, I'm not sure that it can produce that. And so therefore, in another way of looking at life, and I think this is the life that all great spiritual teachers and religion founders of religion have looked at, they see the purpose of life, the meaning of life, does not lie in stuff. It does not lie in the accumulation of stuff, nor in fame and power, etc., and status. That those things are at heart empty of the capacity to deliver real meaning and happiness, and that the real purpose of life is to awaken to our true nature, who and what we really are, and to experience it. And the way we experience that is by purifying the mind of its contaminations, which a lot have to do with the contaminations of self-centeredness and the whole drama of selfhood that comes from self-centeredness, but also through the meditation process of learning to tap into, to touch the pure natural goodness and openness and spaciousness of our minds, which is always here, undefiled. So again, this process of getting from here to there is a process that is not easily understood, and not necessarily easily to put into practice in this life of ours. We have many challenges. So that is why, you know, this opportunity that we have to come together in community, to come together, to meditate together, and to talk about and listen to teachings that have to do with this more fundamental meaning of life, and how to live a life of goodness, and how to live a noble life. Life, the life of the Arya, the noble ones, is something that we shouldn't waste the opportunity. So therefore, that's kind of a long-winded way of me saying, don't be shy or ashamed or feel, you know, that you know, you shouldn't have any questions. We should have a million questions. This is not easy. So if anybody has any questions about the practice and the application of practice in daily life, to our healing and transformation, or please feel free to ask it. Don't be shy. Yes.
Lately, I don't know what the problem is, but I think a few things, but I've been dealing with a lot of doubt.
A lot of?
Doubt.
Doubt.
And I think I'm just trying to kind of muscle through that.
Doubt about?
About the practice itself.
You mean the meditation, you mean whether they're really useful, or
yes,
whether they work, or whether you really want to do it?
Yes.
All that stuff. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. In the traditional teachings, where it talks about the kind of worst or the most heinous things that one can entertain in one's mind, doubt is right up there, which is interesting. Because, and that needs to be understood, because on the one hand, we see that going back to the Buddha himself, he told his followers, you know, he said, question everything I said. He said, do not follow the teachings, do not practice the teachings, just because you respect me or love me, or because I'm the Buddha, or because of this and that. And this, you know, he really said, you know, chew over it. Right? Test it through your own reason. Test it through your own experience. And only then practice. Right? So in a certain way, that kind of questioning of the teachings to make sure that it accords with our rationality and our experience is encouraged. But at the same time, doubt, and I'll explain what that means, is discouraged, not because, you know, this is a cult, and, you know, but it's because it is so inimical. It so sabotages one's own capacity to really heal and transform. One of the biggest things not to doubt in Buddhism is, or two things, really. One is that each of us has this Buddha mind. I mean, if there's an article of faith in Buddhism, it is this. It's an article of faith because it is not our experience. It is the Buddha's experience. It is the awakened master's experience. It's the awakened people who are running around this world. I mean, it's not, I don't want to make it sound like it's such a big deal or it's so remote or mystical. But most of us, when we begin our practice, we begin our practice not in a highly enlightened, awakened state. Right? Now, again, we know that Buddhism began with this one human being, this Indian man, Siddhartha Gautama, having an experience of enlightenment through his own introspection, through his own meditation, in which he kind of peeled away all the levels of conditioning, all this stuff. If you can imagine, all your stuff gone, all your issues gone, all your conditioning from childhood and life, all gone, and you experience directly the pure innate nature of your mind. Right? And in that realization, you understood fundamentally your birthless, deathless, totally interconnected, interbeing self, non-self. Okay? And so that was the first Buddhist teaching. You know, he said, unbelievable. I'm paraphrasing. He said, unbelievable, after his enlightenment. Every human being, whether they're tall or short, rich or poor, man or female, you know, all that, he gave all the opposite. Everyone has this awakened nature, this Buddha nature. Okay? Buddha means this awakened one. So he said, everybody has that nature. So to doubt that is a dangerous thing. Because there's no then real inspiration. There's no aspiration to practice. So that's one thing. The other great doubt, the thing not to doubt, is one's capacity. So many people might go, oh, all right, I can buy that. Everybody has this innate Buddha nature, this pure stainless that is still present in everyone. You know, it's like the analogy of the mirror. You know, the mirror purely reflects things just as they are. And even though, you know, when we look at a dirty mirror, we don't see its capacity to reflect things purely, right? Because it's dirty. So we doubt that there's a mirror really there. But we know that what? If we polish it, if we clean it, it can return to its natural shining brilliance, pure reflection. So we may not doubt, but we may doubt our ability to realize it. So we might say, oh, other people can do that, but not me. Why? I'm too busy. Or I'm too neurotic. Or I'm such a lousy meditator. I'll never do it. Or, you know what I mean? Or I'm just not capable. Right? There's something really broken about me. Or I'm deficient about me. So to doubt one's own capacity to awake is also considered sinful in that sense. And then, of course, you know, to doubt the teachings. Again, I say that only after what I said earlier, which is Buddhism encourages people to hear the teachings and reflect on them and chew on them. But once they've met your test, right? That they do, that they are rational, that they are practical, that they are efficacious, right? Then to doubt, right, that fact which you already know is just allowing kind of the doubting, neurotic mind, you know, to continue to run your life. And I'm sure, for those of you who hear that doubting voice, You've heard it in other parts of your life. It's the voice of your neurotic self. It's just that same voice that you always hear inside that always has a reason to tell you that you are less than you are capable of. That you can't do it. That it's too hard, too much. None of that is true. Why do I say that? Because for 2,500 years, people just like us, two eyes, a nose, a mouth, ears, you know, legs and arms, have come to awakening through these practices. Okay? That's all. And still to today, that same thing happens. So people who follow this path and practice it and devote themselves to it in a committed way, come to realization of some sort. And to doubt is to allow, again, the untrained, skeptical, neurotic, self-doubting part of your mind to continue to run the show. Which is why most people come to the path. They're sick of that. But unfortunately, the truth is, what? That part of you shows up. Right? You come to meditation, your seat on the cushion, right? And who shows up? Who shows up, Chris? There he is. Right? You thought you left him at home, right? He shows up. And so that's the truth, isn't it? That's the truth. And so we have to deal with it. But we have to be able... What's your name again?
Shay.
I mean, but you have to be able to see it. And to label it, that voice, crazy people, right? When I say crazy, I mean, I spend my whole life as a mental health professional, but people that we say are crazy, right? People we say are that are psychotic, people we say are delusional or what, are people that hear voices in their mind telling them all kinds of things and they believe it's true, right? Well, Shay, you have voices in your mind that tell you all kinds of things. We all do. And we have to be aware that we hear these disembodied voices constantly giving us all kinds of messages. They come out of nowhere. It's just a voice in our head, right? And we believe it's true, what they say. I mean, that's kind of crazy. Because that voice can say contradictory things all the time, can't it? One day it can say, Shay, this is good. I can do it. Next week it says, this is not so good. I don't think I can do it. Maybe I should do something else. I mean, which is the true voice? It gets confusing. And then there are probably all other kind of voices in between. And as long as we run our life, those voices you hear on your head are the voices of your past. They are your conditioned voices. Right? They're the voices that have conditioned you in this life. If you listen to them, you will never change. Right? Because those are not the voices of what you're capable of. Those are the voices that are telling you who you've been. And if you don't see that clearly, and realize you don't have to listen to them, and that you can create another inner dialogue. Right? You can create other voices in your head that'll be helpful to you. Right? I mean, if you're gonna have an inner conversation with yourself all day, it might as well be a good one. Right? I mean, it might as well be a helpful one. I mean, it might as well be one that helps you achieve goals that you want to achieve, helps you become the person you want to become, right? I mean, doesn't that make sense? I mean, why continue to have inner dialogue with yourself that just keeps you doing the same stuff that in your more rational moments you know that you don't want to do anymore? Right? I mean, that's crazy. Please don't take that personally. and include us all in that. But that's crazy, isn't it? You know, up to now, we have all lived lives that are conditioned unconsciously by others. We have lived a life that's been conditioned by our families. I mean, you know, who mean well. I mean, it's not, but I mean, the way we think, our values are the values of our families, of our upbringing, of our culture, of our ethnic group, our religion, of our elementary school teacher, middle school teachers, you know, all the way up, right? Mentors, I mean, that has conditioned us to be a certain way, right? And people who live in live a conditioned life just continue to live in the world the way they've been conditioned to live by their past, right? That's the way most people live. They never stop to ask questions. You know, why do I do what I do? Why do I think the way I think? Why do I act and react the way I do? You know, did I freely choose it? No. I've been conditioned by life to be this way. When you understand that, then you can say, I want to live a life that's much more conscious, right? I want to decide where I go in this life. I don't want my past to be directing me, right? I'm an adult. Remember that? I'm an adult. Remember how important that was to us when we were, you know, 18 and 20? I'm an adult. I can make my own decisions and choices. And yet we don't. We think we do. But we're just acting from our base impulses and our conditioning and all that. We're not living freely. Living freely is the capacity to step back from all that conditioning, to see it for what it is, and to consciously see, where do I really want my life to go? And then to live in a conscious way, a mindful and aware way that I direct myself. It's sort of like shade. When you're clear where you want to go, right? You know, you do everything you can to support Shay in moving along his path. Right? You support him, you nourish him, you're kind to him, you know, right? But sometimes you got to take him by the ear. You get back on the path, right? Sometimes you got to talk that way to him. Because he's what? He can be unruly, can't he? Right? And he can wander off the path into all kinds of mischief. Right? And worse. So sometimes, you know, I mean, I'm all for kindness and goodness and that. But sometimes you just got to take him by the scruff of his neck. Come on back. Put him back on the path. But first you want to be clear, you know, that you're really clear that you know where you want to go. So it's not 1 week you're putting him on this path, and a month later you're putting him on that path. You know, decide what path you want to walk in this life. And then commit. But I mean, we know that, right? I mean, if you don't do anything in life, accomplish anything in life, unless you're committed. Any other questions? Somebody in the back? Musha, yes. Just speak up, the air can be a little loud.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, and that part, I think it's handled more easily. But how do you handle something where your life is going
you're grieving because things are falling apart.
Especially when somebody passes away, somebody has
I know, that's a good question. Yeah.
Somebody you were close to, very close to, and they were honest, effective. You were not prepared for
it. Is everybody here? So the question is, how do you deal with really the unexpected, but tragic in everyone's life, such as somebody who's close to you and seems to be things going fine, all of a sudden they die. Just out of unexpected, and it's devastating. It feels devastating. Let me work back, okay? Because it's hard to work. Let me work from the general to the specific. Because I think, Usha, it is the general that helps us deal with the specific. Which means, my values, my philosophy, the way I look at life. From the Buddhist perspective, which even when I say the Buddhist perspective, it's wrong, because the Buddha was a behavioral scientist, the Buddha was. He observed life. I mean, he was not a philosopher. He was not a metaphysician. He was very practical. I mean, and his whole spiritual search was based on looking at life. And one of the things he looked at life and he noticed, right? Remember, he left the palace. Because he saw that, just what you said. Right? He saw that in his little narrow, safe little life that he had been living up to then, where everything was good, and everything was healthy, and right, he had these experiences where he went outside of his life. It hadn't affected him yet, right? But he was perceptive enough where he saw that sickness, old age, death were part normal parts of life. As Buddhists, there is something called, in our kind of chanting service, that we do something called the five remembrances every day. I am the nature to be sick. Everybody gets sick. I am the nature to grow old. Everyone grows old. I am of the nature to die. Everyone I know, including myself, will die. Everything that comes together will separate. It is the nature of things. So, and there's one more, but I wanted to just share those. Those are said every day and meditated on. So one understands that death, parting, is normal. The only unknown about death is when it will come. Right? That is unknown. But, I can only speak personally. I have come to terms, I have children, I have loved ones, I have family. I have come to terms and meditated on the death of every one of them. Because I know it'll come at some point. As a father, as a son, as a husband, do I want it not to come right away? Would it be nice if it goes on? Yes. But on the other hand, am I clearly understanding that it could come tonight? Yes. And I don't think that's morbid. I don't think that's pessimistic. I think that's realistic. Death, sickness, old age, parting is normal. It's not abnormal. It doesn't mean that when you love someone, right, and all of a sudden there's a loss, or when you have a loved one and you see them suffering, that you don't feel compassion. You know what I'm saying? It's not that. But that other whole piece, which is, I can't believe this, or why does this happen, right? You don't go into that because you know it does happen. The thing that for most of us, which is true, is I can't believe it's happening to me. That's really what, I can't believe it's happening in my life. A couple of you know that when I was just on retreat in North Carolina 3 weeks ago, many of you know my daughter who comes here, Karuna, just had a baby 4 weeks ago, 4.5 weeks ago. And when I left to go on a retreat 2 weeks ago, healthy, fine, and all that, and I think the second to last day of retreat, I get called out of retreat, there's an emergency. It turns out the little boy started spitting up food and couldn't take food and spitting up blood and became listless, and it was a real trauma, right? And when I got the call, there's an emergency, I thought, you know, I know my family wouldn't be calling in retreat unless I had to be ready that what? It could be something significant. It might have died. Do infants die? Yes. Right? I mean, and they, luckily he had something that could be operated on and it was fine. So, you know. But, I mean, that is, you know, it happens. You know? I mean, our good fortune is what? Good fortune of my family, the good fortune of my daughter was what? You know, that we live in a country where there's good medical care, right? And she could be, you know, and the baby could be diagnosed, and we have expert pediatric surgeons who could go in and, you know, and do a quick little you know, surgery for the belly button, and you know, and all of a sudden it was the opening between the intestine and the stomach had closed. There's a name to it. So he was just wasn't getting any nutrition, so that's why. But, you know, I thought to myself, in so many places in the world, how many mothers, their babies die? Because there's nobody to diagnose, or there's no treatment, you know what I mean? Or how, you know, that's our good fortune. But, I mean, these things happen, don't they? Everybody dies. Do we want young people to die? No, we want them to live, to be old, right? We think the old should die. But the truth is, we all know young people who have died. And I think, you know, we have to live and be, you know, we have to be careful that we don't artificially try to create a life, a bubble around, you know. I think as a natural thing, we want to create a bubble around ourselves and our loved ones and our family, right? That everyone will be safe and protected. But we can't. Life in a bubble. You know, you talk about those kids who live in bubbles. And it's not a happy life living in a bubble. And if we don't want to live our life in a bubble, then we have to live in this life of what? Of change. Of the unexpected. And that's just the way it is. And so, to understand that and to accept that, I think, is to give one the capacity of meeting all these unexpected with equanimity, with compassion, and with understanding, so they don't throw us. It's funny, I have a 94-year-old mother, and the funny thing always with her, I speak to her every few days, and she's always telling me, you won't believe what happened. And my response is, of course I believe it. It happened to you. I mean, how could I not believe it? You know, but she's always, it's just funny. I mean, these could be the littlest things in the world, but everything is introduced was, you know, you can't believe it would happen. Of course it happens. Everything happens. Right? Everything happens in life. Good things happen in life. Bad things happen in life. People come together. People part. People are born, people die, people are healthy, people get sick. I mean, isn't that the truth? Aren't those the facts? And we, you know, I think what practice helps us do, Usha, is live in reality. But with peacefulness and understanding, equanimity. That's why, you know, the simplest... What time is it?
8:30.
About 8:30? Okay. So let me just say, so we, on a certain way, we say this is kind of a philosophy of life, right? But let's come back to meditation. This is where you really learn. Because when you sit on the cushion, is everything wonderful? Has everybody here tonight just been in a bliss of samadhi? Joyous. Only one person is willing to. Good. But if you sit long enough, you've only been here for a couple of minutes. If you sit long enough, if you go on retreat and sit day after day after day, you will experience what? Everything. You will experience blissful mind states, and you will experience miserable mind states. Right? You will experience every type of mind state just by sitting. Nothing's going on. It's all coming up where? Inside. And if you learn that no matter what mind state arises, you hold it all in mindfulness, you hold it all in equanimity, and you are undisturbed, right? I am aware that there's misery. I am aware there's happiness. Right? I'm aware that there's peacefulness. I'm aware that there's anger, resentment. And you just hold it in mindfulness. Right? You give it a lot of space. It won't contaminate you. And you'll learn that you have the capacity, right, of holding the greatest joy or the greatest tragedy and sadness with this mindfulness, with this spaciousness. So it's not just philosophical, it's actually you know how to do it because you've learned how to do it from your ongoing practice. That's why I say the object of practice is not to bliss out. Because that's just a temporary mind state. The object of practice is to develop the capacity to be present to whatever arises in equanimity. Whatever arises. That's freedom. Right? If I have to have it blissful, then I can't have it miserable. That's not freedom. I'm caught. Freedom is, you know, I'm happy when I'm blissful, I'm happy when I'm miserable. I mean, that sounds crazy. But it certainly can be known. You want to find that place of that middle place. Not the place of extremes. Happy, sad, up, down. You want to find that middle place. So you still experience happinesses and you still experience other things, but it's calm. You're at ease. Right? And that's not that hard. It just takes what? Practice. Right, Shay? Just takes practice. But what's going to inspire you to practice? You have to believe it's worthwhile. It's going to take you to where you want to get to. And then if you're inspired that way and you believe it, you have to make a commitment and undertake discipline, training. Because it just doesn't, just thinking it doesn't make it happen, does it? You want to run a marathon?
Yeah. A literal marathon?
Yeah, a literal marathon. But let's say you did. Right? Let's say you did. And let's say, you know, you don't have any real problem with your legs and you know, physically, okay. So now you have the idea to what? To run a marathon. And then you read about it, you think about it, you meet some people, talk to people, and you say, yeah, I can do this, right? And I want to do it, right? Now, does that mean you can go out and do it? What do you have to do?
Practice.
Yeah, practice. And do you start with 26 miles the first day?
Of course.
So it's really no different. You know, it's really no different. Is that clear? But again, you know, if you know that your body's basically capable of it, then it's just a matter of, you know, training and commitment. If you consistently put at it, one day you will what? Run in a marathon. You may not win. You may come in last. But at least you've what? You've done it. And And that's the way, you know, all of us may not have the capacity of being a fully enlightened Buddha, and right? But we all have the capacity in our own life of becoming more awakened, more enlightened, more liberated. And that's the truth. So we'll stop here.